Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing real good. Had a good week. How about yourself?
Well, you know, I have. Last night was a kind of a big deal. It was the final David Letterman show. Did you happen to catch any of that?
I did not, but I've never been much of a David Letterman fan.
Then you probably
would. I like the new Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and I guess I like Jay Leno okay, but never much of a Letterman fan.
He was awesome when he showed up like in the 80s, you know, the early 80s.
Yeah.
He was this really fresh new thing, and his first show on NBC, and I think maybe even the first few seasons of his show on CBS were pretty good. Actually, the first show was amazing, and the first few seasons on CBS were pretty good. I have not watched him much lately, and I didn't tune in last night, but I caught a few minutes of it on the internet earlier today, and something that he said that caught my attention, I thought was pretty funny. He was talking about the fact that all told, over 33 years, he and Paul Schaefer, his musical guy, have done 6,000 and some shows. Okay, so just amazing number of shows. And he said he was really delighted to hear that to hear from Stephen Hawking, who had been looking at this and doing some calculations, and he had figured out that the 6,000 shows that added up to almost 8 full minutes of laughter. So I feel like, you know, there's either it works for you or it doesn't. I thought it was pretty funny.
All right, Phil.
Eight full minutes of laughter. I like to feel that, you know, out of the several hundred shows we've done, there's been, you know, a good 30 seconds of inspiration somewhere along the way.
That's right. Yeah, there's a good 8 minutes of laughter. Well, you know, yeah, it reminds me of the Stephen Hawking interview. It was on Steve Colbert or one of those shows where, you know, in an alternate universe, Stephen Hawking is asked, you know, are you as dumb as me? And he says, no, but, you know, and there's also no alternate universes where you're funny.
Exactly. So, you know, the go-to smart guy who puts people in their place, I guess, is
that's right.
Stephen Hawking. But anyway, no one has said that. I don't know. You know, out of our 500 or so shows, it could have been, you know, a full minute of inspiration that people have received. I'd like to think it's been somewhere in that vicinity. So, I know you've got a story to tell about virtual reality. And I think
we can work virtual
reality into the show later, but go ahead and let's start with that. I think that's kind of interesting.
Okay, so my kids have been thinking about, and you know, ever since they've heard about the Oculus Rift, they've wanted to try it. They wanted to, you know, what is that like to be immersed in virtual reality? And they've been, you know, asking me, Dad, when was the first time you heard about virtual reality? Well, late 80s, I guess. You know, the concept has been around for a while. You know, it's just one of those things that's just, it's forever 5 years away. But they got to try it, you know, at the Best Buy here in Shreveport. So that's it's hitting the market these days. And so
not to say anything bad about Shreveport, okay, but Oculus Rift is now at the Best Buy in Shreveport. Okay, I mean that says something, doesn't it? I mean it has arrived.
It's here. You know,
yeah,
we're in flyover country, and it's at our local Best Buy, so that tells you something. So,
yep.
Anyway, so they got me on the phone. Dad, this is amazing. You know, they're playing games and stuff in complete immersion. They say it's not like looking at a video screen at all. You are in the game. You look up, there's
right.
sky above you, down. You know, I mean everything. So
you've gone to a different place when you put the thing on.
Yeah, exactly. And and so Matthew is like, he's wearing this thing. He's shooting at bad guys and stuff in the game. And I guess he just assumed he was a floating head in the game. You know, because he didn't. Because when he looked down, he was completely freaked out. And he yells at the top of his lung. I mean, half the store stops and looks at him. You know, he goes, "Hey, I've got a body! I've got a body! Check this out! And I'm buff!" You know,
right on. Yeah. Well, that's the great thing about virtual reality, right?
That's right. You could be as buff as you want to be. And his brothers, like wanting to crawl under the carpet. But at the same time, I was wanting to bust out laughing at him. It was a funny scene, and that's a big deal. It's something that's has been on its way for all our lives practically, Phil, and now it's finally here. So
part of it is here.
Piece
the
of
visual
here.
Part of visual and audio part of virtual reality seems to have arrived. When it's tactile. Okay, then we've really got, then we've really got virtual reality. But this is a huge step in that direction. And I think it's truly the first time you can claim that kind of real-time, fully visual immersive experience, right? That's never been possible before.
Yeah.
There have been visually immersive experiences, but there's a lag or it's really lame.
Yeah.
And this is
Matthew
not that.
Said it was as smooth as glass, the experience. I mean, you look this way, that way, it's smooth as glass. And I said, well, is it photorealistic? He said, not quite.
Mm, okay.
Again, the games, what the 3D shooters look like. They look great, you and I having come of age, Phil, on things like Doom and Wolfenstein and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, I mean, they've come a long way since that. But it's not photorealistic yet, and
I don't see that as a huge drawback because it's what I see photorealistic all the time anyway. So give me something else.
Right.
Put me in a cartoon. Put me in a
right, Epic Mickey or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
You can go nuts with virtual reality because it's just wide open. I can see your point there. So maybe photorealistic's not what we should be aiming for anyway.
So very cool. Here it is. Virtual reality has made it to the Best Buy in Shreveport, but it's still you got to pay for it. There's a problem.
Yeah.
Now our show tonight is called "Make Everything Free," and over on Blog Talk Radio, we even gave it the tagline, including this show. So we're starting tonight with this show. So listeners, just to let you know, tonight's program is brought to you 100% free of charge. It's there for you.
We've cut our prices 100%.
We have. Yeah, and I feel pretty good about it. I feel pretty good about it. Tonight, we're just giving the show away.
We are giving away our content.
That's right. Giving it away to anyone who wants to listen to it, enjoy it, learn from it, build on it. It's there for you. Okay, it's an absurd idea. Let's start with that. Why don't we start with that? Make everything free is a kind of an absurd, childish idea. In fact, it might even be a dog that poops money. For regular listeners who know what that refers to, just a glib idea that somebody throws out that has no grounding in the real world and is not worth pursuing. Now, I'm going to make the case. Well, of course, I made the case that dogs that poop money was a good idea to pursue. So, I don't feel like I have to. I don't have to reinvent the wheel there, but. I'm going to make the case that maybe there's more to it than that. that that perhaps this idea is not just a glib and silly idea. Perhaps it's an absurd idea. Perhaps it's an idea that that can't be fulfilled in the way we would think or the way we would expect, but that it's worth spending some time on. I mean, it's just, you know, before we get into the how we came to be talking about this tonight, just picture a world where everything is free for a minute. And it's really hard to imagine it. I mean, imagine this world, right? The world we live in, only nothing costs anything, right? You go to Best Buy and you just pick up your Oculus Rift, and it's yours. There it is. They had one in. You got it. You know, you go to the supermarket. Yep, there's some ribeyes on the shelves. I'll have some of those. You know, whatever the best, right? I mean, the problem presents itself almost immediately, right? It's like, well, everybody would be going for the same stuff, and assuming that, you know, it's this world where there's only so much of everything. How do you resolve that? Right. In fact, right. I was thinking about this earlier. A world where everything is free. I mean, it's great. You go on Amazon. It's just like, well, I'll take one of these and one of these and one of these, and you know, just send it all to my house. But everyone would be doing that, and then there would
we'd end up in the world of Wally. Yeah, we'd end up in the world run by and large, and look like with Wally cleaning up after us, right?
So. Well, we actually, I don't think we get that far. I think everything would fall apart a lot, you know, sooner than that, because there's just no way, there'd be no way to keep up for it. And of course, everyone's giving their work away for free too, because it's free, right? But you don't need a job because food's free. I mean, on the one hand, it sort of works, and on the other hand, you can just see where it would just collapse. I mean, here's where you know it's not going to work out, right? Okay, so houses are free, right? Who gets the beachfront house? Right.
Yeah, because there's only so much of that. Yeah, there's always going to be something that's worth something. That for example, we've talked about this, Bill. How even a place in line, you know, if there's a line to get something, the guy that's in first place in the line has something of value that the guy that's 20 back would like to have.
Right.
You know, I'd like to be first in line. I could tell you what, let's trade, and that's worth, you know, what's that worth to you? Well, you know, that's so there's always a there'll always be something that people will want to bargain for, even in a world where practically everything is free. But how do you get to that world? Well, I guess automation is how you do it, right?
I think so. I think the first point is that you can't have everything be free in the world we live in now, right?
It
wouldn't work. I mean, in fact, people who have seen this idea make everything free and snorted at it, I'm sure have responded that, you know, anyone who's taken Economics 101 knows that idea is nonsense. And I'm very pleased to say that I had to drop Econ 101 after about 3 weeks, and I never added it back into my course load, so I didn't finish Econ 101, so I'm, you know, perfectly happy to do a show about this. The thing is, just because an idea is absurd doesn't mean it's not worth talking about, because the show is called The World Transformed. So we say, okay, well, the world as it exists couldn't support everything being free. And I'm afraid I don't have a formula, even in all the things we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, to actually get it to where we're in a world where everything is free. But I think we can get a lot closer to that than we are currently.
Oh, yeah.
I think if we implemented some of these ideas, and they, some of them kind of contradict each other, and some of them don't work very well together, and some of them kind of overlap in odd ways, but it suggests that we might be a lot closer one day to a world where everything's free than the world we live in now, put it that way.
Well, imagine a situation, Phil, and this is what we kind of see coming our way, is a world that's very automated and so many jobs, including not just the guys that are working on the line down at GM. We're talking also, jobs in offices and everything else have been automated to where, you know, there's just a lot of people that, you know, perfectly smart, perfectly willing to work, but there's just not the work for them because everything's been automated away.
But
at the same time, because everything's been automated away, and you know, you don't have to pay robots, and you know, they don't, you know, they just happily work, you know, 24/7 with no breaks, and continue to produce stuff. Then you have an abundance of things that are being made and services that are being rendered. but not a lot of money chasing those things. And so you almost think there's, you know, there's, so there's two things driving prices down in that world: an abundance of stuff, and
right.
and a lack of money at the same time. So, you know, things just, you know, prices fall and fall and fall until, you know, it, very little money will buy a whole lot of stuff. And but then again, you know, what does it take to earn that very little bit of money? Well, you know, it's it might be a little bit difficult to do if there's no jobs to be had. So that's it's you know, there's some scariness to that, but there's also, I would say, it, you know, there, you always find an equilibrium, and you know where there tends to be the money for those who want to go get it, and you know, and you just have to figure out how to go about doing it, and you know, I think we'll get into that I think later in the show.
Well, absolutely. I think you make some really good points there, and automation is definitely key to a lot of this. I think there are other things that factor in, but I want to wind it back just a little and talk about how we got on to Make Everything Free, because this show wasn't originally going to be called Make Everything Free. That was a leap that I made. It started out, we've linked these two articles in the show notes on blogtalkradio.com. I see over on worldtransform.com that only one of them carried over, so I'll get that link up there after the show. But there was a piece in the New York Times by the economist Tyler Cowen, and a piece over on Bloomberg with Megan McArdle commenting on what Tyler Cowen had written, talking about an inevitable reset of the economy that they see coming. And it's a very interesting subject. It touches on a lot of the stuff that we talk about when we talk about the dangers of risks related to automating large sections of the economy. They didn't spend, neither Tyler nor Megan spent a lot of time on that side of it. You know, they were talking about just kind of how the incentives that we've built into the economy kind of work us in this direction. And interesting examples about, you know, as employers, we want to pay the least to get something done, and as employees, obviously, you want to get the most. And somewhere in the tension between those two things, we've had sectors where certain jobs are just, they're paid less and less and less, and you know, the deal seems to be not as good for them as it used to be. Now, I look at that and I say, you know, that might partly be true, but it's also just true that a job that's worth a lot of money in one decade isn't worth a lot of money in another decade. It used to be that you'd have to wait like a century or so to see that transition occur, but now it happens a lot faster, and it's just an inevitable aspect of being better connected, and you know, the consumers, and by that I mean the people we normally think of as consumers, but also anyone who's consuming anything, so whether it's the government or big business or whoever it is, those that are consuming the services of other people, they're always going to drive to the best bargain that they can possibly get. It's like electricity trying to find ground, right? I mean, it's just that's the dynamic,
yeah,
that is always that's always going to push that. So why is it different now? You know, if you look at the world we're in, we talk about this all the time. It's different now because virtually everything ultimately gets automated. So a person's ability to do these things is becoming less and less valuable as the machines become more and more valuable. So when these economists, or McArdle's more of a pundit, I suppose, talk about an inevitable reset of the economy, you know, I feel that what they're saying, and if you read these pieces, Stephen, you can check me if I'm wrong, but I feel that what they're saying is, well, it's going to be hard, and people aren't going to get paid as much, and we just kind of have to aim our expectations down. Was that your take on what they're saying?
Yeah,
right?
It was a downer article, no doubt. And
yeah.
I don't see that at all, Phil. I see that while jobs will become fewer, and the amount of money might actually be less, that's chasing around goods, there's going to be more and more goods and services out there that are available, and so chasing, and those goods and services are chasing maybe chasing fewer and fewer dollars, but that makes the dollars more valuable, right? And so, you just, you know, it makes it a very different world, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we're sitting in hovels wondering where our next meal is. You know, it'll be a very different world is all.
Yeah.
I don't
agree that, the dynamics at work, that the changes that are occurring or the technologies, and the social changes that could be made in light of those technologies that are, you know, that are potential changes that we could do. I don't agree that those all speak to bad news economically. That's where I really, depart from these two. And you and I were swapping emails about this, and I said, you know, we need to talk about how you would have a positive reset of the economy, right? You know,
right.
let's talk about how some of these factors could work together and make things really good. Because the truth is exactly what you just said, that all of the technological progress that we've made over the last couple centuries has worked in exactly that direction. It's created this huge abundance of stuff. It's created an enormous abundance of energy. It's created an enormous abundance, thanks to the internet, of people being connected and ideas being swapped around and people being able to know new things and do new things that they couldn't do before. One of the reasons I believe that you hear so much about income inequality these days is because that's about all you can harp on. You can't really talk about poverty the way you once could have. Not to say there's no poverty in the world. There's definitely poverty in the world. And not to say there's no poverty in the U.S., but I'm telling you that you're a lot better off being a poor person in the U.S. than you are being just about any kind of person at any other time in history before now.
Right.
Right? Just in terms of the, you know, the resources that are available to you.
A poor person in the U.S. today would be better than a rich person at the founding of our nation. You know, be better off. You know,
That's why we can't talk about poverty. We talk about income inequality. You know, it's like you change the target a little bit and you say, well, it's still bad news. It's like, well, okay, but the good news is, we're better off than rich people used to be. which is pretty cool, you know, when you think about it. And let's take some of that same kind of thinking and apply it to how good things can be. So that's when I got this idea about, well, how about just free stuff? And I came up with numerous scenarios for how we could make various things free. And then ultimately I changed that over into make everything free. I don't know if we can quite get to make everything free, but here are a few of the ideas that I came up with that we could strive for. And these are listed in the show notes here. Free government, free money, free energy, free healthcare, which we haven't talked about, Stephen, but we've sort of talked about it before. Free stuff, kind of a big one. That should probably be first. And then I see free paycheck, free ownership, which sounds a lot like free money and is probably another version of getting that same thing. But I want to talk a little bit about each one of these ideas. And we can, you know, we can assess their plausibility, okay, as we go. Desirability, I think you don't have to talk about, right? Is there any of those things that, you know, you just say, well, I don't want that to be free, right? I look at it and go, actually, anything I can get for free, I'll take, right? is that too simple-minded? It seems like, you know, if I can get it for free, I'm not saying if the world will work or any of that kind of stuff, but just it's like, here, you can have a free house or you have to pay for it. What do you take? You know, it's like, oh, okay, well, that's not a tough choice. So we're not going to debate whether these things should be free. We'll just debate whether this would be the way to get to it. Is that fair, Stephen?
Yeah, there's an argument, I suppose, that could be made about having some skin in the game. You know, if you have to put, you know, your labor into earning money to buy something, then you tend to appreciate, you know.
That's true.
Is that a good thing? Well, yeah, I think a lot of times it is. I think that people that own their homes, have pride in their possession. I went out and bought the home.
Yeah, it's, pride of ownership. It's just you hear that. You know?
Pride of ownership. Right, it's a good thing. And I, you know, it's something that, I'd like more of my countrymen and people throughout the world to be able to do, is to to own their little, you know, their own castle. You know, that's kind of the thing.
But what I'm saying, I guess, is that from where I sit, right, I think it's really good for other people to have earned the stuff and all that kind of stuff. But if they give it to me free, I'm fine.
I want the free house. You want to be the trust fund baby. Okay, I get it. Okay.
Yeah, I'm okay if the universe becomes a trust fund and just starts handing me stuff. I'm going to be like, it's good. It's okay. I'm still going to have, you know, I'm going to have good character and good values and all that stuff. Trust me. Just give me the stuff. It's going to be fine. And I kind of feel like everybody else feels that way too, right? So that's why I don't want to spend too much time on that. But I do, you know, joking aside, there is an argument there, right? There's an argument there that
things are worth something
to the extent that...
I got it.
things are worth something to the extent that you have to work for them, that you have to strive. You know, I mean, there's a whole value argument around that. But we'll deal with that. We got more shows coming up. We'll take that one on. Tonight we'll just talk about whether these are good ways to get free stuff. Is that fair?
Okay.
All right. So I had this idea of free government. I started with this one, just because immediately when you start talking about giving away everything away for free. There's this fear that, you know, someone's going to say, oh, well, you're just talking socialism. And I'm really not. You know, I personally believe that when we talk about technology driving us in new directions, it probably kind of breaks all the existing categories to some extent, and it doesn't really fit into any of those models. And ideally, in a true post-scarcity world, which is what we're talking about here, you end up with something kind of like what Karl Marx described the world would be like when everything finally worked out, right, and the state withered away and, you know, everything was perfect. Like that, only better, right, because the robots are doing all the work and everything's free. So, you know, it's like Marx's end state without his revolution and dictatorship and all that stuff leading up to it. So it's a little bit like that. But the means of getting there might be more like, you know, Adam Smith, or it might be more like, you know, just the traditional market economy stuff, or it might be something completely different. But anyway, the reason I put free government first, I don't think it's the most important one, but just to get my small government bona fides here, okay? It's like, okay, look, I'm not saying make the government huge. In fact, why don't we let government lead the way? And if robots are going to steal jobs, let's go full bore automation of government. Let's make that the first thing that we completely automate, right? Every government function, everything, right? Even defense, except for, we talked about this last week and we've talked about this a few times, except for where we need some people in the loop, because we don't want this, you know, machines making these kill people decisions. But the rest of it, you know, it's like Skynet minus that that kill decision, right? The post office, road maintenance, all the regulatory functions, the DMV should be a bunch of kiosks, right? You know what I'm saying? Everything, just take all of it and make it machines, right? All bureaucratic, all administrative functions. It'd be a great way for government to lead, right? Because if we could automate all of government, there's so much of the business world we could then automate based on what we would have learned by automating all of government. So we could massively slash the cost of government and, the way I see it, you know, slash taxes accordingly. So it wouldn't be 100% free government, but we could massively reduce the cost of government by automating it. What do you think, Stephen? Good idea? Bad idea? Something we could do?
Oh, it's a good idea, but I think it happening is the chances are remarkably remote. Government is by its very nature the last to adopt things, not the first. My understanding is that up until I think it was about halfway through the second Bush administration, that the IRS updated some of their software and finally retired software that had been running since the Kennedy administration. not even joking. I mean, that is, you know, the sort of thing, you know, would a business operate like that? Absolutely not. But, you know, that's one thing about being the U.S. government. You are a monopoly. There is no other, you know, competing U.S. government that requires them to, you know, stay on top of things and to be innovative. So you see things like that happening last in government, not first. And also, I mean, there's this thing, you know, government jobs. When all other jobs, when the private sector is automated, because they're going to do it first, they innovate, then where will people look to for jobs? You know,
right?
I think some of it'll be there'll be more and more and more and more government jobs. You know, and it might be, you know, completely, you know, doing nothing government jobs, but it'll still be, you know, that will be one way that that society deals with it, probably, as to the transition is to, you know, give us do nothing jobs, you know, that kind of keep us, you know, doing something.
I think that's a really interesting point. It's probably more likely that most people will end up working for the government than that we will automate most of the government, right? Short to medium term. I think eventually we will automate all of government because the whole idea of we'll eventually get post-employment. We'll get to the point where the whole idea of having jobs won't make sense anymore, and then we'll say, well, okay, well, I don't want to keep doing this meaningless, you know, rubber stamp government job. Let the robots do it, and people will find ways of getting subsistence elsewhere. But I think you're right. I think before we fully automate government and have free or next to free government, we'll probably have a situation where either the government's heavily involved in everybody's livelihood or we're all just plain working for the government. Neither one of which sounds all that appealing to me personally. Yeah. Those don't sound great. But there's probably ways to make those fun scenarios too. You know, maybe that would be my homework is to, well, okay, let's say we all work for the government. How could that be fun? How could that be a positive? How could that be a positive scenario? I think it probably could if you worked on it, if you worked on it hard enough. It doesn't sound great. Okay, so free government, great if we could do it. I think we will do it eventually, but we're not doing it anytime soon. And for all the social reasons you said, I mean, what I'm describing there in free government is basically a massive layoff of a lot of people. You're talking about, you know, a lot of people losing their jobs, and that's kind of mean. And I'm saying let all these people lose their jobs so that we can figure out how to do it in the business world too, and all those people lose their jobs too. What's the matter with me? Why am I thinking this way? Well, let me tell you why. Because of the next idea, okay? Free money, all right? Free money is the best idea ever. You know how you know it's a great idea? If you ask any small child what to do about poverty, you know, what to do about the fact that some people are rich and some people are poor, they'll tell you that's the thing, right? We'll just have the government give people money, right? And not only children, but adults have tried this all throughout history and over recent decades in this country with mixed at best results, okay?
Thank you. You're being kind.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure that it's done some good for some people in some circumstances. But overall, you know, it hasn't – what is it? President Reagan said that, you know, in the 60s we waged a war on poverty and poverty won, right? Basically, you know, the idea of just handing out money to people to fight poverty hasn't seemed to be in and of itself a great solution. So where in the world – would you get this idea that something like basic income could ever work? Well, let me tell you why I like it. Of all the welfare state ideas, this is my favorite one, which, you know, maybe that's not saying a lot, but it's saying something. Because this is the idea where you take the whole welfare state and you throw the whole thing out, and all you do is you just give regular cash payments to everybody. And I think one of the things that people miss out on is it's not just like an entitlement program where, you know, poor people are getting money. It's like we all get it, right? Whatever it is, if it's, you know, $15,000 a year, right? The guy on the street, you know, who's living in a dumpster, he would start getting $15,000 a year. Yay! You know, it's awesome for him. And
his life has changed. He's no longer in the dumpster. He has a little apartment somewhere. And, you know.
Steven, you would get it. And Bill Gates would get it, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like we would all get that, right? So it's like it's the basic income. Absolutely transformative for some people. It would be this weird little offset thing to many of us, and it would be completely meaningless to a lot of
people.
Bill
Gates.
But
yeah,
to Bill Gates, you know, to a few people at the very top. But what it does away with, it's another way of kind of getting to the free government, although, you know, obviously there's still a lot of money changing hands here. It just, you know, all of the bureaucracy around who gets what and you know, deciding all that kind of stuff, it all goes away because we just all get the same amount. Now, and there's still plenty of reason for, you know, people to keep working, because it's like, if you're getting $15,000 a month right now in welfare, or excuse me, $15,000 a year in welfare, there's no reason for you to go take a job paying, you know, $10,000 a year, you know, working
as a clerk
in a store or something like that. Yeah, you can lose your $15,000 if you do that. But
that's right.
In this model, you'll be making $25,000, right? So, you know, you're way better off, you know, working that system. So the incentives still exist. Now, this is a way, if we're moving towards a system where robots are doing most of the work and most people don't have jobs, or a lot fewer people have jobs than used to, this is one possible way to offset some of those. And I included a link to I don't know if I did I put the link to the YouTube in the show notes. I got to put that up there. I didn't. I'll have to add that. I don't know who he is. Some German authority on the subject explaining this. And it's pretty good little video that kind of talks through the high points and the, you know, why this would work. And I'll put it to you, Stephen. What about basic income as a way of making everything free money for everybody?
It would not work in the world that we have currently, Phil. But,
okay, and why is that?
And there's just not enough money to go around. It's the old socialism problem that Margaret Thatcher pointed out. Eventually, you run out of other people's money. You know, it's a great deal socialism, but eventually you run out of other people's money.
Well, it feels like, okay, yeah, that's the thing. It's like you look at if I'm getting $15,000 back, right? It's like an automatic.
Right.
You know, for me, it would be like, you know, that's a very nice tax refund, right? for people in our position. Yeah, it's like somehow there's just not a big enough pot for that to work, right? What's left over to actually make the government happen isn't enough.
My thought on basic income can't work now, but it might be the only practical solution in a few years when everything is automated.
Right.
So many services out there that chasing fewer and fewer dollars. You know, the ability to give people basically spending power, you know, for no work it becomes easier and easier in a more and more automated world. And at some point it becomes the best system. And, you know, you pointed out something about basic income that the video didn't do as well as you did, Phil, and that is that, you know, you don't, since everybody gets it and it's not a disincentive for work because you can, you know, you don't get taxed on that 15 and you don't lose the 15, you know,
right,
the basic income. By going out and working like you would if you're losing your welfare if you went out and worked under the present system. And so, which creates a huge disincentive. You have to get not just a job, but a good job to even think about, for it to be a rational decision to even think about going to work.
Yeah, well, it's got to pay a lot better than the welfare. I mean, it's got to pay a lot better than the welfare to make it worth,
exactly,
you know, that extra,
you know,
like you're working now.
Quite
right?
Frankly, sitting at home and watching television is more pleasant than most jobs. And so,
depending on what's on, but yes.
Exactly.
But especially once you're in the habit of not working, I mean, there's just this, you're right, there's this whole disincentive to work that's just kind of built in where you would think, imagine it's paying $15,000. I don't know how much people are getting, but imagine you're getting $15,000 a year in some kind of government benefits, and you say, "Well, there's a job that pays $13,000." I'd be crazy to take it, right? I mean, you know, it's, I have to work 40 hours a week, and right now I can stay home. But even if it paid $17,000, I don't know. You know, that's an awful lot. Awful lot of effort for a $2,000 increment. But if you got the $17,000 job and you're still getting the $15,000, well, shoot, now you're a lot better off than you were.
Yeah.
And people would jump on that incentive. Plus, the other good thing about it is that you've just got all that, you know, the money, rather than, you know, channeling, bumping along through bureaucracies and being slowly filtered out, it's in the hands of people and they're out spending it. And I think the economy just gets a lot healthier on that basis. You know, the whole stimulus plan that we had a few years ago that didn't do much in the way of stimulating was because, you know, it was all tied up in one thing or another. I think you actually probably do get some kind of stimulation effect if you just give people money and they go out and spend it, right? The economy gets a bit of a bump.
You know, the cynical reply to this, Bill, is that, you know, this basic income idea will never work because there's insufficient opportunities for graft.
Well, that's what Glenn Reynolds would say for sure. Yes.
Yeah.
That's why we got to put the robots in charge. That's why they're going to be running the government. You see, because they don't care about graft.
You don't
bribe a robot.
You can't bribe a robot. That's right. Yeah. I got this extra special oil here that we can oil your joints with.
I'm going to jump down to free paycheck, free ownership, because these are really related, and I want to come back to the idea of there's not enough money to go around. Now, I have heard from no less of an economic authority than our old co-host Michael Darling, okay, that if you took the national GDP and divided it by the population, do you know how much that would come out to per capita?
No telling. What you got?
It's about $70,000 a year, okay? So, but, you know, that'd be a fairly decent basic income. Yeah, you know, that's not bad, but that's GDP, you know, I mean, you'd have no military, then you'd have nothing, right? I mean, it's just like pure chopping up the GDP and handing out to people. So that it's not realistic, but it's an interesting way of looking at it. Okay, if you start from the standpoint of gross domestic product, you know, who's actually, you know, cranking out the value? Because increasingly, you know, the wealth generation that we're seeing, it's done by, we've talked about this before, companies that aren't all that big. They're not really getting any bigger in terms of the number of people who work for them. They're getting huge in terms of the amount of value that they have, but they don't have large staffs. So you've got, you know, companies controlling a huge amount of the world's economic productivity that don't require massive amounts of people working for them. So, you know, companies like Apple and Google, you know, they generate huge revenues, but they don't provide a livelihood for anything like the number of people that a company like GM did back in its heyday, right? All the big manufacturing companies did. So maybe the idea is you tax these companies based on their overall contribution to gross domestic product, right? So it's kind of like the ultimate income tax. It's a variation on what John Smart has referred to as taxing the machines, right? Because ultimately these companies are making a killing off automation. You know, they're kind of the owners of the robots. The robots are making them extremely rich. So it's like, okay, well, we'll do that. We'll put a progressive, quote unquote, that's the term that's used, tax on GDP contribution, and then we're going to just pass it back out one way or another. You know, they can either take it upon themselves to say, okay, well, we're Apple Computer, and we're now going to, quote unquote, employ 1 billion people, right? Whatever it would be, it's probably not that big, but you know, you get the idea. These big companies would say, you know, we've got this many people who actually work here, and now we've got this many people on payroll, right? And it's this much bigger number that they're going to basically mail checks to, you know, because they own that much of the GDP. Now, the other possibility is that simply the ownership of those companies could be divvied out. You know, you might say they have this many, this big of a headcount, but only this many people actually work there. Or you might say they have this many owners, but only these owners actually get to vote on, you know, what the company does next. It could be treated either way. And the ownership idea might even be more appealing because in that case, rather than pretending that people are doing work that they're not doing, we would just be acknowledging that we've taken this and kind of distributed it, right? You know, this is the you know, long-awaited, for those who are into this sort of thing, redistribution of wealth, okay, in a Robin Hood
and of course,
kind of way.
The companies would be for it if they are being paid by the government for their stock. So the government buys stock from successful companies and divvies out basically a mutual fund of these stocks. You know, it could be the S&P 500, it could be the Dow Industrials, whatever. You know, it would be a mutual fund of those things, and that would be divvied out to citizens, I guess. And that would be, and you know, you could do that in lieu of the basic income idea. Again,
yeah,
everybody would get it, and therefore it's not a disincentive to work, because you get it whether or not you work.
And so, I think we could do this, again, speaking of somebody who had maybe three whole weeks of Economics 101, I think we could start thinking about doing this if the economy was twice as big as it is, maybe, or three times as big as it is. You know, it's within an order, we are within an order of magnitude, economy size, of being able to do this. And, you know, the thing is, we've got the automation capability to grow our economy rapidly, to grow it massively. We're not focused on doing that right now. Maybe one of the things we need to make that happen is my next one, free energy. Okay, and I know we got to go fast because we spend a lot of time on free money. But let's forget everything else for a minute, and let's just put a big program in place to drive energy costs as low as we can possibly get them. Okay, and everything's on the table. All right, so we'll drill oil, we'll cut shale out of the mountains, we'll frack. Right, okay, we're gonna keep improving solar. We're gonna put these small safe nuclear plants that we've heard about. We're going to finally get fusion working, all of it, right? Put big like tax incentives in place, big bonuses, whatever we need to do to have everybody
producing more energy.
Space
solar that we beam down. We have the space solar, space-based solar that's beamed down by microwave beams 24/7. You know.
Yeah, helium-3, all of it. Every good idea, all working together, get energy costs down as low as you possibly can. You make energy free. Practically free. It's still not going to be free, but much closer to free than it is now. And you make everything cheaper. Suddenly the economy is much stronger, and then you can start talking about let's double the size of this economy and double it again. And then some of these other things come into play. I think that probably turning a corner and resetting the economy in a positive direction has as much to do with this piece as it does with anything else. When we get smart about making, well, and maybe one other one that we'll get to in just a second. When we get to where energy is an information technology and we're growing it in the same way that we can grow information technology, advancing it in the same way we advanced energy technology, then we can really start moving towards a world where things are, if not free, a lot closer to free than they currently are. So that's my idea. And what do you think, Stephen? Would that be a workable notion?
Yeah. I think that is the direction we're going. Let me give it as a kind of an example, kind of the parable here or whatever. Imagine this actually happened to me as a college student. I'm driving home from college and I see a middle-aged lady on the side of the road with a flat. Okay, and I pull over. Do you need any help? This is in the days, in the dark days before cell phones, before people had cell phones.
Right.
And of course, she needed help. And,
let me see the $20 lady like that. Is that what you said?
Well, that's funny you should say it that way because I didn't ask for $20, but I pushed
her.
I got the jack out, which she had no idea about how to do,
right. And
jacked it, changed her tire, and she said, "Well, thank you so much. It was a huge help. Here's $20." I said, "You're welcome. It's not necessary, but I was glad for the $20. I'm a college kid, right?"
Sure.
I take the $20 down to the gas station and fill up my tank, okay, and had five left over. You know, that's how gas was back in those days. It's not
wow,
terribly
there
expensive.
You go.
And so, now imagine it's my grandson, a good number of years from now, same exact scenario. Somehow the lady does not have the ability to call. Maybe cell phone's broken or whatever. Changes her tire. She again.
He fixes her robot, basically, is what he's going to be doing.
The robot that was supposed to fix the tire is also broken, and so she's really in a fix. And so, he says, "Well, allow my robot to fix your robot and fix the tire, and we're all good." And here's a 20 for your troubles, and And so he takes the 20. Thank you very much. I've been needing a new car. He goes down to the.
He doesn't buy a gallon tank of gas.
He goes down to the car dealership, and you know, they 3D printed the car, you know, with literally no human hands touching it in the entire process, from the time of extraction of the raw materials to the time that it's, you know, rolling out on the floor. Literally no human has touched it until my grandson touches it and hands him $20 and rolls out of there.
And does he get $5 back?
Yeah, and he gets $5 back. You know?
Absolutely, right. Yeah.
So they're in, you know, same exact story. It's just in same denomination of money, but it's, you know, the difference obviously is worlds in which there's so much more in goods that are out there chasing those dollars. So anyway,
right, and you know what? Free energy is a piece of that, and the next one is the other piece,
yeah,
which is free stuff. Okay,
yeah.
And this is to make real the promise of two emerging technologies, one that we've been talking about for a very long time, one that has really just come on the scene in the last few years and promises to be very transformative, and that is molecularly precise manufacturing, nanotech, for those of us who still like to use that term, and 3D printing, exactly what you were talking about there. When you turn the production of goods into an, I was talking about turning the production of energy into an information technology, turn the production of goods into an information technology, and that's exactly what you get. You get the $20 car and get five back, you know, you get $5 back.
$15
you can,
car.
You know, go on vacation for, you know, a month, right, with your fiber.
$5.
Yeah. Basically, all you need is energy, right, which we've already said, let's make that as close to free as we can possibly get it. And, you know, I use the word dirt, but basically just raw materials that are available around. And, in fact, the big push for free stuff might be just making sure everybody has enough dirt, right? Just making sure everybody can get their hands on scrap metal or whatever it is that's local that you need to make your stuff out of. So rather than my scenario that I gave at the beginning of the show, where we're all, you know, all just able to log into Amazon and get anything we want to for free, we're just making it at home. Or there's a local distribution center that's like Amazon where you can go get anything you need and get $5 back from your 20. And I believe that the free stuff scenario becomes much more tenable, much more believable, the farther you get with free energy, right? The cheaper you make energy, the more progress you can make you can make towards that one. I don't know that we'll ever have free energy. But, you know, I think we'll have energy cheap enough that if we're all taking a, you know, whatever it is, $15,000 a year check, whatever the equivalent of that is in a couple of decades, from the government or from Google, who now owns the whole universe, it'll buy you all the energy you want. It'll buy you all the dirt you want. And it'll buy you all the...
At some point, it gets so cheap at some point, Phil, that they don't bother to meter it anymore. So it's practically free at that point. You know, maybe at some point, you know, the government just says, you know what, it's so cheap now, we're just going to cover it, and you know, we'll write the check for it rather than you know, us even bother metering it anymore because it's just that cheap. It could be something like that.
There you go, and that leaves the one that I skipped over as we were bouncing around here among these, which wasn't in the original list that we talked about, Stephen, but it's a huge one, which is free healthcare. This one is different because there's a service aspect to it in addition to a you're buying stuff aspect to it. And we know that Watson's going to medical school and that ultimately a lot of expertise associated with providing medical care can be automated. But this is the one that I think you have to solve or you have to come very close to solving before you can, you know, to wind it all the way back before you can do basic income. Because the thing missing from basic income at that point, you know, say it's a $15,000 a year payment to everybody in today's world, that's going to get you nowhere, right, with the cost of health care.
Right.
You know, if you have one bad thing happen, you're going to blow your whole, you know, your whole year's basic income on just that one thing, the way health care is priced today, the way it's set up today. But if you can automate government, if you can make energy free, if you can just keep pushing Moore's Law along, if you can make stuff free.
Dr. Watson's in every hospital.
I think you have a shot at driving healthcare into the same kind of $5 for a car. I love that story. As everything else, I think that it's like getting healthcare will be like showing up at an information kiosk at a mall to find out directions or something like that. I mean, not to overly simplify something complex, which, might be the administration of medicine, or you might even need surgery or something like that. But I'm just going to say that resource can become as abundantly available as, information at an information booth. And when you've achieved that, I think we're done. I think at that point we live in a world pretty much where we've made everything free.
Yeah, yeah. And are practically so, where the $20 buys a car with $5 change. You're getting there. You're getting to that point at that point. So absolutely.
That's virtually free. I mean, it's like net zero. They were still charging like $5, right? this is kind of the same idea. Okay, free is a marketing term. But you get it to the point where absolutely everyone can afford it, and it being pretty much anything they want. Yep, the beachfront house will still be expensive, but the most beautiful house you can imagine will be available. Anybody who wants to will be able to have it. It's a world where everything is free. And you know what, Stephen? I think we've, in a short period of time, made a pretty good case. Now, in a few weeks, maybe we'll come back and we'll do a show about why people have to pay for things in order to feel good about it. But right now, I feel pretty good about a world where everything's free. How about you?
Pretty good. There's something to be said about having things to do with your day and.
Okay.
In a post scarcity world where you don't have to work because things are so cheap, practically free. What do you do with yourself? I think what we will find ourselves doing is collaborating to do things that are our that whatever our passion is, we will find that and collaborate with people worldwide to do neat and interesting things. And this was brought to my attention. This particular project was brought to my attention. It's Eric Whiteacre's virtual choir. I saw it on a TED Talk, Phil. And our music tonight is going to be one of those choirs. Now, what do I mean virtual choir? I mean literally people submitting. Hundreds of people submitting their little part of a song that Eric Whiteacre has wrote, and then he uploaded a video of him directing the music so that they could keep pace with it. He's doing the hand motion. He's doing the choir direction, and people sing their parts. And so you have all these people submitting it, and and he said he learned that these people that were submitting it, many of them would do it 50 times and submit the best they did out of those 50 times, and then he would select out of those the very best that hit the particular parts that he was dividing it up into. And so the result, you'd think, well, that's going to be you're talking about YouTube videos, audio quality is going to be terrible. Actually, is absolutely gorgeous. And Phil, the name of the song, I hope I'm saying it right, is Lux RMQ, and that's what we're going to be playing tonight for our music.
Amazing. Interesting to think that maybe one of the best choirs in the world gets created out of just these individuals contributing all of their work. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together, and thank you all for being with us this evening as we talk about our future where everything is free. I also want to mention, speaking of some upcoming free shows, we got our regular show next week, and then the following week, Monday, June 1st, is going to be a very special show. We're very excited about this. Our good friend PJ Manny is going to be with us, and she's going to be talking about her new book, Revolution. Actually, there's been some discussion about, is it revolution or is it evolution? We'll find that out, and we'll see you all in 1 week. Until next time, live with you.